this is Ukraine Calling, a weekly roundup of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on the main issue. I'm Marta Dechok for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here are the headlines that caught my attention this week.
Absolutely the same situation like Russian bombardment in Aleppo. They have only one purpose. World should be less stable, less secured. I want to insist that the Russian aggression east of my country and in Crimea completely destroyed the post-war global security system based on the UN Security Council.
Тож за минулу добу внаслідок бойових дій один український військовослужбовець загинув і двоє отримали поранення. Висловлюємо співчуття рідним та близьким загиблого воїна.
Ukraine was celebrating this week. It marked the 25th anniversary of its modern statehood. A quarter century ago, after the Moscow coup failed, Ukraine's parliament convened in an emergency session. And on the 24th of August, 1991, it adopted the Act of Independence. Later in the show, we'll bring you an interview with Serhii Holovaty, who co-authored the Act. He'll explain what was happening behind the scenes and the ideas that shaped the historic moment. And Bohdan Nahailo, who headed up RFERL's Ukrainian service in 1991. He describes how news of the independence declaration traveled from Ukraine's parliament to Munich and got transmitted onto international airwaves. A quarter century later, with war on their territory, Ukraine's leaders feared that the independence celebration might become a target for terrorist acts, so there was a heavy security presence in central Kyiv. But on the actual day, the mood was relaxed. Despite the rain, thousands of people came out to watch the annual parade. They patiently stood in line to get through the metal detectors that surrounded the main square, the Maidan. The parade itself was quite something, unlike anything over the past 24 years. President Poroshenko introduced a new narrative. He placed the emphasis on Ukraine's 1,000-year history, with this 25th anniversary being only the most recent phase. He honored all those who had been killed while defending Ukraine over the centuries and handed out awards to current war heroes. Then, relatives of those who'd been killed over the past 2.5 years opened the parade. Next came rows and rows of soldiers and sailors. They were marching in a new way, not the old Soviet goose step. And they were dressed in new Western-style uniforms. They were making a fashion statement to demonstrate a break with the past. The finale was military equipment. Multiple rocket launchers, self-propelled anti-aircraft mounts, tanks, and other items that I didn't recognize. As they rolled down the main street, Khrushchatyk, the ground shook. The young men driving the equipment had a steady and determined looks on their faces as people clapped while they passed. All of Ukraine's former presidents were on the main platform. All except the fugitive former president Viktor Yanukovych. By the afternoon, the sun came out and the weather remained lovely for the annual evening concert that I'll describe later in the show. On Monday, Ukraine Prosecutor's General Office released a video that documents Moscow's direct involvement in triggering the events that led to the annexation of Crimea and the war in the Donbas. It contains fragments of intercepted phone conversations. One is from February the 28th, 2014. It's between Putin's official advisor, Sergei Glasyev, and Russian State Duma deputy, Konstantin Zatulin. They're discussing financing unrest in Odessa, Kharkiv, and the Crimea. Another is from the 6th of March, 2014. Glasyev is advising Sergei Aksyonov, the man who took over Crimea's parliament, on the wording for the event that many call the Crimean referendum of March the 16th, 2014. International media did not report this story widely. Kyiv-based German political scientist Andreas Umland believes that this is because the tapes have been carefully cut and framed, and the original tapes remain unpublished. We'll post a link to the video on our webpage. Ukraine's Interior Ministry reports that more Russian National Guard troops have arrived in the Donbas, and heavy shelling continues. Over the past week, 6 soldiers were killed and 26 were wounded. More disturbing news came out of the Crimea over the past few days. On August the 18th, Crimean Tatar leader Imli Umarov was forcibly taken from a cardiac unit in a regular hospital and transferred to the psychiatric hospital number 1 in Simferopol. He'd been under observation for his heart condition and he's a diabetic. The Kharkiv Human Rights Group and various Crimean Tatar organizations are reporting that his medication has been taken away from him and that initially even his lawyer was not allowed to see him. He'll be held in the psychiatric hospital for 28 days. During the Soviet era, psychiatry was used as a weapon against political opponents. Umarov is facing charges for calling Russia's actions in Crimea an occupation. It will now be easier for Ukrainians to install their own energy meters in their homes. The government streamlined the process this week. It has directed the National Energy Company to inspect these meters within 3 to 5 days. Many apartment buildings still have a centralized meter system, which makes it impossible to accurately measure energy usage in individual apartments. So many people have started installing their own to keep track of their own energy consumption and bills. To remember the day that Parliament voted on the Act of Independence 25 years ago, Ukraine Calling invited two special guests into studio this week. 25 years ago, Ukraine declared independence. And since then, there's a lot of people who say that it was very easy. The process just sort of happened. Lightly, Ukraine is now fighting for its independence. In studio today, we have two very special guests. One who was an author, the co-author of the Act of Independence of Ukraine, and the other is a journalist who was covering the events and actually broke the story from Munich. Mr. Nahailo was then the head of the Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe Ukrainian section. Sidhi Holovaty was a member of parliament and a very active, one of the founding members of RUH. And so we have two different perspectives. Thank you very much for joining us. Mr. Nahailo, I'd like to start with you. You were sitting in Munich and carefully watching what was happening in Ukraine. Radio Liberty then was the enemy. How did you have information coming from Ukraine? Can you tell our listeners how you were following this story?
Well, in the old days, when it was still very difficult to travel here and when programs were being jammed, and jamming only stopped in November 1988, as late as that, despite glasnost and perestroika, so-called, at that time, we were monitoring very closely the Soviet Ukrainian, but Soviet press. The Americans who were running Radio Liberty and financing it above board, because after 1971, until then it had been financed by the CIA, but after 1971 it was run by a bipartisan commission. And there was a phenomenal apparatus for gathering information, for monitoring. In effect, the main radio and TV broadcasts were being monitored on a regular basis. In some cases, when we already had video, we could see these programs. But before then, overnight, we would get transcripts made for us. So, for example, when I came to work in the morning, I would already know what Radio Kyiv had been saying, what was on Vremya the night before, etc. But I'll give you an example how sophisticated it was. The Soviet Union had 11 time zones, huge country. But to make sure that the first page of Pravda in Vladivostok was the same as in Kaliningrad, early editions were sent by satellite to Vladivostok, for example. The Americans would pick this up, so we would know what would be on the first page of Pravda that day, that morning, so we could already prepare our programs and counter-arguments.
However, sorry to interrupt here, when there was very breaking news, like the emergency session of Parliament on the 24th of August, 1991, you were telling us, how did you follow that story? Because that was a very difficult one
well,
to follow.
Well, Marta, you're jumping ahead. A lot changed between 1988 and 1990. First of all, you had the appearance of all these informal groups, as they were called here. You had a burgeoning civil society who had their own independent press and who were courageous enough to spread information and to try and contact us by telephone. It was very difficult. And certainly by 1989, 1990, we already had stringers in Kyiv, in Lviv, reporting by telephone, sending us faxes. Fax machines already existed. And so it became a much more sophisticated sort of operation. I've always emphasized for those younger people who are now so used to social media that we were the Twitter and the Facebook of that time. We were the ones that were telling people in Donetsk what was happening in Lviv, Odessa, what was happening in Chernihiv, and integrating the nation, a nation not in a political sense, as a political nation. But you asked me what happened on that very memorable for me personally day. You know, it was a Saturday. There was an extraordinary session of the Verkhovna Rada, the Ukrainian parliament. This was 2 days or so after the collapse of the putsch attempt in Moscow. And let's remember those dramatic days. You know, Oras Septelny, our renowned historian from Toronto, who said before his death in an interview that when he came here to oversee the publication of the Ukrainian edition of his History of Ukraine, that week, when he phoned the editors here, they said, "What book are you talking about? There's no such book being prepared." People were very frightened. And for a few days, even that theme disappeared off the radar screen. But once trauma had subsided and once it was clear that the putschists had failed, here the expectations were, following along the lines of what Yeltsin was doing in Moscow, that perhaps the Communist Party would be banned. Already that would be a major, major achievement. But it was not clear by any means that the issue of Ukraine's status, it was supposedly a sovereign state already by a former declaration, but that it would now proceed to declare itself independent. I brought in the staff as the director of this service on Saturday. Usually we prepared programs in advance, but I said I felt that something important was going to happen. So all day we were sitting there, half of the staff, waiting for news from Kiev, from our correspondents, from Serhiy Nabok and Svetlana Rebushavka and Leonid Milyavsky. At 6 o'clock Kiev time, 5 o'clock Munich time, we were supposed to go out live with a broadcast of international news. But at 10 to 6, there was still, at 10 to 5, Munich time, there's still no news. So I got onto the phone to our correspondents in Kiev, and Svetlana Ryaboshapka picked up the phone and said, "Pane Bohdane, you know, Kravchuk, the Speaker of Parliament, is putting to the vote the act declaring Ukraine's independence." I said, "No, come on, this can't be true." She said, no. And I don't believe you. So she said, "Oh, well, listen for yourself." And she took the receiver, held it to the TV in Kiev, and I'm listening over the phone in Munich to Kravchuk reading the text, which we'll return to, the authorship of it, and at that stage, you know, the cheers and the applause. And I realized something dramatic had happened. My responsibility as the director was, what do I do? Do I run with that news? Do I believe what my ears have told me and my correspondents? Or do I play it safe and wait for an hour until everybody else has broadcasted? I ran to the news booth. The red lamp was already on, saying no entry, but I had the prerogative of going in as the director. And Vasil Darchuk, my colleague, was supposed to be reading the international news in about 2-3 minutes' time. And I scribbled down by hand, "За попередніми даними Верховна Рада щойно про..." You know, that according to preliminary information, the Ukrainian the Supreme Soviet has... Rada has just declared...
Supreme Soviet.
Soviet at that
Supreme
time still.
Soviet.
Thank you, sir. He's a legal specialist, and of course he was there.
It
and
was
he,
not
he
yet
knows.
Rada, it was Soviet.
Those, yeah. And I say, "Read this out." He looks at me, puts his finger to his head, and tells me I'm crazy through the glass. And I'm saying to him, "Read it." I'm pointing with my finger and saying, "You will be in big trouble if you don't read it." And he points to his throat as if somebody's going to slit his throat, going, "You know what this means if I read this out." And I'm saying to him, "Yes, you'll lose your head if you don't." So he went ahead on my instructions And at 6 o'clock Kyiv time, we were first. We beat Ukrinform, TASS, AP, Reuters. We were the first to broadcast it. Now, why was that important? Because it was a Saturday, and even though there was relief after the failure of the putsch, a lot of people were at their dachas. They hadn't been glued to their TV sets watching the Verkhovna Rada. So in many senses, we were the first to, millions of people were listening to us. We were the first to bring that news ahead. And the footnote, well, we had to celebrate. But of course, the canteen in Radio Munich, run by Germans, Ordnung, was
closed
at 5 o'clock. So I had to go bang on the doors and say, Ukraine has declared its independence, give us some champagne, or rather sect. And they were saying, what? No, 5 o'clock. I said, look, history is being made. Do you want to be part of history, or are you going to be, you know, sort of bores? So they got out the champagne, and the staff drank, and we drank to an independent Ukraine. That was 25 years ago, and that's why it was so special.
Mr. Nihailo broke the story of Ukraine's independence to the world. Serhiy Hulavati was one of the people who made it happen. Mr. Hulavati, tell us how this act of independence was prepared. You were one of the authors. Tell us what, how this, we have in front in the studio with us here, the draft of the act. Can you tell us how this was prepared?
We have to go back to the to those days in renewing our memory about the composition of Rada,
the Parliament of Ukraine at the time.
The composition of the Supreme Soviet of the Ukrainian
Soviet, proto-parliament,
Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. Ukrainian.
That's right.
It was not yet Rada in Ukrainian, but it was Supreme Soviet. At 450 members, among them not more than 110, those were anti-communist part.
Democrats.
So we'll say Democrats who constituted a non-formal alliance of which was called Narodna Rada, that is People's Rada or People's Council. That is, that means that less than a quarter, less than a quarter of MPs were the idea of independence. All the rest were Orthodox communists, members of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Certainly, when the coup has occurred in Moscow on 19th of August, it was not clear what is going on there. And myself, I was in Russia, by the way, because it was a holiday period for MPs, August. Some of us were on holidays in resort area near Rostov-na-Donu. There is Mineralne Vody, the resort area of all MPs from all over the Soviet Union, were also were MPs from republics and from Moscow. And when we came to for breakfast at 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock, we heard from radio about the coup. And immediately we started to find a way how to get to Ukraine, because we didn't know. That was almost martial law. Everything was blocked, and it took about the whole day to come to Kyiv by plane. The only plane which was allowed to get off from Rostov-na-Donu to Kyiv and Moscow, by the way, that was the plane which belonged to, which was registered in Borispil Airport. That's why even Moscow MPs, members of the Supreme Soviet of the USSR, they couldn't get directly to Moscow. It was blocked by militaries, and the captain on the board was from Kyiv, from Borispol. So that's why we were lucky to be back in Kyiv about 10 or even 11 p.m. on 19th, and immediately with our sacks, baggage, with my other colleagues, came to Rada, to the building where our Supreme Soviet is located, and joined the group who demanded to convene the extraordinary session. The speaker of the Supreme Soviet, Kravchuk, was hesitating. He didn't do that on 19th, on 20th, on 21st. he still was waiting for
the end.
For the end. That's what right. Direction the events will take place, and only after that it was clear that the coup is failing. That when he convened the extraordinary session, that's why these MPs from Narodna Rada, they met in the house of Association of Writers in Bankovo, Budynok Pismenników, and there was a special meeting of this Rada, of Narodna Rada, Democratic Bloc, to work out the scenario, how it will go on. And according to the unanimously adopted scenario, we have drafted the agenda for this extraordinary session. The agenda contained about not less than 12 points.
That's a big agenda.
Yes, big agenda. Wow. Number one, that was the resolution on banning the Communist Party. Number two, decommunization. That is on decommunization. That's banning, so to say, lustration. Mm-hmm. Banning to take positions for the former communist bureaucrats, apparatchiks, nomenklatura, to take any positions in the offices of the
government structures.
Possibly proclaimed independent Ukraine. Then number three, denationalization of the property of the Communist Party and putting it in the property of people. So the last item, as I would say, so I don't know how to tell in English, apotheosis. That is the
apogee,
the apogee,
sort of
the crowning point.
That is proclaiming independence of new Ukraine as already decommunized, mm-hmm. already democratic, and so on and so on. That was should be the last point. The last point. That was the agreement or the decision of Narodna Rada. But and it was adopted on 22nd, mm-hmm. on 22nd of August. And it was decided that we will prepare, that Narodna Rada will prepare the draft of all these documents, by the way, all these documents.
Right.
And we had only one day, 23rd, to do it. It was one day. And it was done. It was done. And then we met for the next meeting on 23rd in the evening in the...
The Writers' Union building again?
No. Already
in
Parliament. Mm-hmm. We have already discussed the prepared drafts. And the scenario was supposed to be like this. When we came for the meeting on the 24th, the plenary meeting was opened. The first secretary of the Communist Party, Mr. Hurenko, was admitted or was allowed to speak on behalf of the communists, what they have done in Moscow, and certainly what is their line or the kind of behavior.
Sergei,
in Kyiv.
I'll just interrupt you. In my book called The Ukrainian Resurgence, one of the photos that I went to great trouble to find is mm-hmm. of Hurenko raising his hand. Can you imagine the first party secretary mm-hmm. asking to be given the right to speak? How things had changed.
Yeah, exactly. So he was allowed to speak, you know. But put it very short, or short in a short way. Finally, we came to that moment when we had to start to adopt
the agenda,
the drafts, the agenda, the documents according to our
plan.
However, the Speaker of the Parliament, Mr.
Leonid
Kravchuk,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Kravchuk, suddenly announced that. The floor is given to member of Rada of the Supreme Soviet, Mr. Yevorivsky, for announcing the act of independence.
Mr. Yevorivsky, for our listeners, was a member of RUH.
Yes, exactly.
So he changed the agenda.
He was the member of the Presidium, which was at the time Presidium of the Supreme Soviet, like a Politburo of the Supreme Soviet. And it appeared that in the night there was special agreement between the presidium and speaker that they will not follow our scenario and that they will vote only for one issue, for proclaiming independence. Only this, because they were afraid that if you put if the scenario would be like we have planned, so that's why it would we could fail to proclaim independence, because the communists, they were a majority, super majority.
That's right.
They were super majority.
Mr. Lukyanenko said a few days ago that he suspects that Yavorivsky was being secretly prepared as a possible leader. If Kravchuk were to be removed and the others, that he would be acceptable to the communists.
I don't know that, but I remember because Lukyanenko, who was authorized by Rada to pronounce that document, mm-hmm. was standing in front of me. I was sitting in the first row.
That's
there.
Right. You had that.
Yeah. So he was standing in front of me with the sheet of paper
that had
was already written this text, which was had to be voted. But suddenly, when Kravchuk has announced for Yavorivsky just came and pulled out the sheet of paper from Lukyanenko, and Lukyanenko started to cry. Because that was betrayal.
Yeah.
There was some kind, you know, something in unexpected. And Lukyanenko was crying. The teardrops were coming out from the eyes. And so he's crying.
Crying?
Crying. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was also his birthday.
Yeah. And so, but finally, it was done so unexpectedly that nobody could identify what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it was put to the vote, and we had nothing to do as to vote. By the way, some of the Ruch members, including me and my colleagues, others, when it was for the first time put to the vote, we voted against, because we also were feeling that we are betrayed by somebody, because that was not our agreement, that was not our plan.
That you're being hijacked, in effect.
Yeah, we didn't want to vote for independent Ukraine. Of that quality,
yes.
When the communists have the power.
So whether Ukraine would be communist.
I voted against the act, which I was also writing myself, Lukyanenko and me.
Let's
to vote against my act.
But so how many attempts were there to declare independence?
No, that was one attempt. No. Then, when we have voted against the act myself, Kravchuk is putting to the vote the second issue, the resolution. The resolution, additional document, resolution on proclamation of independence, together with announcing the referendum on the 1st December for people's approval. Certainly, when it was proposed to vote at that time, we have voted, and that was 346 who voted finally, because, and we also have voted for that, because finally we could not do anything as to support this idea. So, in conclusion, we see that at that time, I would say so, very active minority, anti-communist minority, very active with at least 100 deputies. They managed to achieve the goal, which was for them as ideal. Ideal, their ideal, our ideal was independent Ukraine, independent from Moscow, independent from the Soviet Union, independent country, gaining independence, as all other nations in Europe or in the liberal world. At the same time, this independence was voted or supported by, I would say, communist majority.
Mm-hmm.
That is aggressive,
that
or I would say,
the aggressive majority.
Aggressive, orthodox communist majority, because it was in their interest. They never pursued an ideal of independent Ukraine, but they voted for, because that was their interest to keep the power.
They were saving.
That's why I voted for the first time against, and then only in favor. So because I understood that voting in favor, they are preserving power.
That's right.
They were saving their skins.
And finally, it was a victory for many of MPs and the Ruch members. They were happy, and I had a double feeling. I was happy and unhappy. It was for me a day of joy, of happiness, and of sadness. And in the evening, they went to a restaurant. In hotel, in restaurant Stolichny, in Khrushchev Street, there was Stolichny, and all communists, Rukh members, they went for holidays, they were drinking champagne, they were singing songs, they were...
Euphoric.
Was that... But I didn't go there.
You didn't join them?
No, I didn't join them. I, with my friend, who was at the time Rukh member, Valery Vasyuk, we went for to TV... That was national TV here. Mm-hmm. Evdokia Kolesnik was a journalist who had annual TV program, news program at 11 p.m. Mm-hmm. It was alive. Mm-hmm. And we went there explaining why we are not singing, dancing and drinking champagne with the others.
Because it was still
communist. Our message was that we didn't want Ukraine's independence voted by communist preserving power. We don't believe, and at that time, that was exactly 25 years ago, what I said in on TV, that I don't believe that Ukraine will be independent in such a way. I said that Ukraine's freedom cannot be gained without bloodshed. The Ukrainian's history has proved that only if it is win or conquered in the battle against the eternal enemy, as we say, Orda, Moscow's Orda, where it was Tatars...
The Horde, the Moscow Horde, the Tatar Horde, the Mongol Horde.
It doesn't, the invaders from the east. Disregarding this. And you know, as we see now, what has happened in 2014, exactly. We have this. This is still the fight for independence. And maybe this, even due to this bloodshed,
well, you know,
we will preserve our independence because this is the main goal of Putin's regime to destroy Ukraine's independence.
If I may just come in for a second, you know, a lot of people, as Marta was suggesting at the beginning, seem to think that, you know, independence was handed to us on a plate, that it fell from heaven,
no,
that Ukrainians didn't do anything. Of course, you know, they don't take into account all the centuries of struggle, and we won't recount all the moments of history.
I disagree with my colleagues.
Even the late 80s, even the mobilization through the popular movement for restructuring, etc. The major achievement of that movement was that it had a clear concept, thanks to people like Serhii, of a Ukraine for all its citizens, not just Ukraine, you know, Ukrainian speaking with one version of history, one version of religion. It was, you know, it embraced all the citizens and it made Jews, Bulgarians, Poles, Catholics feel at home. And that was a major achievement.
It
could have gone wrong. It could have been very nasty. It could have turned into bloodshed. But...
Bloodshed meant not inside Ukraine.
Yeah.
Bloodshed that is
it could have been exploited,
the war,
yes.
The war
but
between Russia and Ukraine, Moscow and Kyiv.
What the point I want to make is that even though there was the semblance of it all happening rather smoothly, what has happened since 2014 and 15 is that the political nation, and particularly the younger generation, has realized that freedom comes at a price. And the blood and the lives, that has been the price, maybe belatedly, that we're still paying for that independence. You know, and I think that was one of the major messages of the revolution of dignity, the Maidan, and etc., that you don't get things for free. And if you want to stand up for democracy, for Europe, for self-identification, for being Ukrainian, at the end of the day, you have to be able, you have to be ready to give your lives for it. And thank God that we've found ourselves 25 years later, or 23, 24, at a stage where we've never been stronger as now.
Exactly.
You know, this is the strongest point in our history, with all the failings, with all the shortcomings and disappointments. You know, we, of course, would like it to have gone better, and the momentum of reform and, you know, national renewal to have gone better. But still, we are stronger stronger than we've ever been. And I'm encouraged, particularly by the younger generation, who have a different outlook, who already have a sense of Ukrainianness, of Ukrainian history, not in any narrow chauvinistic way, but in a European sense. And they certainly don't want a Eurasian, a tyrannical model here. So for me, you know, if you ask me, is the after 25 years, is the glass half empty or half full? I would always say it's more than half full. Yes, it's not going to happen overnight. Yes, it's frustratingly slow and frustratingly zigzaggy, that path. But we are making progress. And final point on that, I just want to say, remember, interwar Poland, interwar Baltic states, they survived 20 years, 1920, 1919 to 39. We've stood the test of time and stood up to all the adverse forces against us, particularly our northern neighbor. And 25 years later, again, we're stronger than we've ever been, despite internal shortcomings.
So the feeling of a political nation has spread over 25 years, but I'd like to go back to 1991, because Mr. Holovaty, you and your colleagues, you were real revolutionaries and visionaries, and you were one of the co-authors of this document that made Ukraine an independent state. Now, coming out of a Soviet tradition, Soviet education, you had the vision how to draft this document, what to put into it. Can you tell us a little bit about the actual act of independence?
Before Serhii does, I just want to interject as somebody who is an analyst following that Serhii represented that rather limited elite of very sophisticated people, legally trained, with a broad international outlook, aware of international standards, and it was thanks to him and his role in subsequent years in the Rada, because I followed his career, that a lot of sense and political correctness and, shall we say, the normative aspects in terms of abiding by standards. So he wasn't just an activist. He was already, he is a very intelligent, clever man, but he was also highly qualified as a professional. And thank God Ruch had people of his caliber.
The main, I would say, factor in this circumstances is that I have graduated from the Taras Shevchenko University as an international lawyer. I was trained on international law. If I was trained as a simple Soviet lawyer, I could not do all these things which I knew at that time already, because studying international law, we were trained in even human rights law, which was, in the Soviet Union, it was almost unknown what is human rights law, because it was a part of international law only. It was not in the Soviet Union a part of a national law, human rights, because there were socialist rights. Ukrainian lawyers, in this, according to this legal Soviet tradition, could not be trained in understanding human rights as rights and freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of demonstrations, freedom of expression. No, never. Only the right to labor, right to housing, right to health, right to education, social rights.
Social economic rights.
But I was studying international law. I knew something about the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, about the Charter of United Nations and the rights of a nation for self-determination. That's why in our act there is a reference, made special reference, that Parliament on the 24th of August has proclaimed independence basing on the Charter, on UN Charter and other international instruments which contain the right of a nation for self-determination. So that's why, and moreover, we were trained international or specialists in international law. We had to know English language, French language, or other, at least two languages, in order to be a specialist in the field of international law. And that was certainly very much contributed to me consult the Ruch movement and the leadership in Ruch how to write the documents, because I has drafted the whole, for example, charter of Ruch movement in 1899. I had drafted two chapters in the Ruch program on, for example, on human rights, on the rights of individual and rights of nation, on the structure of the future, I would say Reichstadt or the state based on the rule of law and so on. You know, that was everything, the heritage I've got as a knowledge, even during the Soviet Union legal education system.
Wasn't Saakashvili one of your colleagues at the same university?
No. He was studying about 10 years later, but I met him in Strasbourg already when I was the member of the delegation of Ukrainian National Parliament, rather to the Strasbourg Assembly. Misha was the member of that assembly.
But he'd studied in Kyiv at the same institute.
Yeah, at that time it was law, Faculty of International Relations, International Law. Now it is the Institute of International Relations. So that was the reason that I had knowledge on that, on the human rights, on the rights of a nation to self-determination, and how that we have the right. Our nation has a natural right for freedom, as Philip Orlik was writing in his memorial on the natural right of a Cossack nation to be free.
And wasn't Professor Vasilenko one of your professors?
He was very active in foreign policy. He was teaching on the international law treaties as a part of international law.
So this document that Mr. Holovate has brought into studio, and we will photograph and post on our webpage for those of you who would like to see it, this was inspired by international documents, by international visions. When you were drafting this, what were the key ideas that you put into this document?
The first key idea, that the proclaiming Ukraine's independence means that we affirm or reaffirm our long, long tradition. Historic tradition of statehood. It is precisely stated that we are, by this we proclaim the continuation of our history more than for millennium, more than 1,000 years, starting with the Prince Volodymyr the Great, who has baptized this Kyiv land in
988,
at the same time when the first French king was put to the throne. That was the first king of France, Hugo Capot, in 987. Mm-hmm. From that year, the French destiny of kings and monarchs has started. So we are all, at the time, we're almost the same.
Right.
French monarchy and Kyiv Rus monarchy with our king or prince Volodymyr the Great, who baptizing Kyiv Rus, or as it was said in Latin, Rossica, which was then stolen by Peter the Great for the name of
Tsar of all the Russias.
Of Russia, Rossica, Ukraine, that is Kyiv Rus, Kyiv Rossica.
And
Rossica,
we became Malorus, Little Russia.
Oh, yes. So, Rossica Rubra.
Yes.
So the long history.
Yeah, that's long history. That was put as the first. I would say thesis. Mm-hmm. In
axiom.
Axiom.
Almost.
Yeah. Then the second was that we are doing that, the parliament, Rada is doing that, just basing on the right of a nation for self-determination, and this is prescribed by the UN Charter and other instruments of international law.
So immediately reference to international norms.
Immediately reference to UN Charter and I would say the two covenants on human rights, so 1966. Mm-hmm. And then the third thesis is we're continuing our action in continuation of the Declaration of State Sovereignty, which was passed by the same Supreme Soviet of Ukrainian Socialist Republic on 16th of July 1990, not knowing that we very quickly would be voting for independence. That's why our basics for our future statehood, like the our military, for example, forces or armed forces of Ukraine, which we never had because that was Soviet forces, or national currency hryvnia, or I would say economic independence from Moscow. All these basics were put down in the declaration on state sovereignty, because Soviet Republic was not sovereign. But since 16th July 1990, we put these basics for future state sovereignty. So that's linkage with the declaration. And so we, on this basis, on three of these basic things, that's long, long historical tradition, more than 1,000 years, the international basis for independence and national basis for independence, which was laid down a year before.
So very sophisticated conceptually and legally well-grounded. Yes. So quite the historic moment, Mr. Holovaty.
It had to be very short.
That's right.
If it is formulated longer, it could raise the debates in the parliament. And with the supermajority of orthodox aggressive communists, we could fail. So that's what it would. This document could not contain such a long, it couldn't be a very long text like, for example, American Declaration of Independence, you know.
It had to be concise and not ambiguous and not provocative.
Exactly.
You had to win them over as well. Yes. You had to find the right language.
The priority was the end independence, but based on these things, three things.
Can I just add, Martha, that one point that we forget now in the context of the Russian aggression in the East, that in 1990, when Ukraine declared its sovereignty, that an important role was played by the striking miners of the Donbass. Remember,
it was organized.
Yes,
it was artificially made strike.
Yeah, it was. But it was their involvement and their presence on the streets that helped us get sovereignty, because it also frightened the communist elite here and etc. But that's now forgotten. But it's something that we should be aware of, because you know Donetsk was not, as it's portrayed by Moscow now, never connected with Kyiv and the rest of Ukraine and its politics and its aspirations.
Thank you. We have co-author of The Act of Independence. We have the man who broke the story to the world. Thank you very much for sharing your insight with us and for joining us.
Thank you, Martha, for having us. And I think all three of us in our way, you know, for us, it's a very important anniversary. We were all involved in some way to a greater or lesser extent. And I think we're all proud that we've lived to this day and that Ukraine... It's not just a project. Ukraine is this, millennial phenomenon which continues to grow and develop, perhaps in ways unforeseen, and will be there. And as I would just like to quote Simonenko, «Народ мій є, народ мій завжди буде».
And in conclusion, I have nothing to do as only to join previously stated by Bohdan that since 25 years, Ukraine is so strong as never before. And so it has such a good perspective for the future as never before.
Because it was built on a strong foundation. So thank you very much for your contributions, for your contributions, and for contributions to come.
Thank you, Martha.
On Independence Day, there were lots of activities all over Kyiv. Art fairs, literary readings, fairs of handmade items, master chef competitions, a charity run in the traditional Ukrainian shirts to raise money for Kyiv schools, and others. The grand finale was the annual concert that's held in Kyiv's main square, the Maidan. This year, it had a new tone. The stage was decorated in the style of the avant-garde artist Kazimir Malevich. He was born in Kyiv into a Polish family and has lately become very popular in Ukraine. The music was classical, and all the performers were born after 1991, that is, in an independent Ukraine. For those who like rock music, I'd like to play you a song by a Kharkiv band Fluhede, which means weather vane. The song is called Sklo, glass.
Thank you. зрушені вітром, заставлені фігурами статично величними. І тремтіє таке відчуття, що саме зараз їх розкрутить і вирве з цих проклятих звичних дахів, що воронячим пір'ям прикрашені, моховими хворобами до ворогів укриті, антенами пірсовані і дротами вижиті, аварійними драбинами і хатками пташиними, що тримають балкони своїм глиняним тілом і соломою голками в'їдаються в шкіру цеглу, покладено людьми, що хворіли потребою забудови і бажанням неба. Людьми, що хворіли потребою забудови і бажанням неба. І до першого сонця їм сни змикались, і вставали відновлені люди скелі, і знали, що часу так недостатньо, що як тільки сонце зайде, їм грудьми на землю. І найбажаним щастям була їм та робота, і цілі села зникали за стінами вежі, що позволили найманці зі східних земель, лікарі з пацієнтами і погорільці з пожежниками. Їм всім же просто хотілося трошечки вітра, бо вежа здіймалась настільки високо, що й вітри не заходили за якісь стіни, і дощі оминали ті покинуті землі. Знеможені і білі підіймалися сходами безкінечними, а діставшись даху, обернулись на флюгери величними провідниками до безкінечності.
Next Friday is the beginning of the Labor Day weekend in North America, so Ukraine Calling will be taking a break. The next episode will air on Friday, the 9th of September, and there will be a new host since I'll be back at my university starting the new term. If you have any suggestions or comments, please write to the show. Our email address is ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. That's ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. I'm Marta Dychok in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.